We'd taken four priority goals and we had put them on the front page of the manifesto on the cover. And we said that whatever power we got, whatever votes we got, we would use that to try and secure progress towards those four goals.
I can remember in Downing Street having the 100 headlines of the manifesto or whatever. We all have them essentially on our walls and we tick them off.
Hello and welcome to Preparing for Power, a special inside briefing podcast brought to you by the Institute for Government. The days, weeks and months ahead are going to be dominated by opinion polls and campaign slogans, policy pledges and manifesto launches. But what about the morning after election night? Whoever forms the next government will need to be prepared, and the job begins almost as soon as the votes have been counted. So what's it like to go from opposition to government overnight? How do civil servants get ready for the possibility of a transition of power or of a hung parliament? And what is it like for a governing party to continue in power after a bruising campaign? In this series, the Institute for Government takes you behind the scenes to find out how our politicians, their advisers and officials block out the noise of a general election campaign to get ready for being in government. We'll be speaking to former ministers, special advisers and senior civil servants to discover how they prepared for that all-important election result and its aftermath, to hear their secrets and to work out the lessons for 2024. I'm Emma Norris, Deputy Director at the Institute for Government. In this episode, we'll be looking at manifestos, which can play a huge part in a general election campaign. They're released a few weeks out from polling day, with the media pouring through each party's pledges. Launch day coverage makes headlines, and the days that follow can see a manifesto shift the narrative of a campaign. And then what? Manifestos have been described as a contract between the party and the people, setting out a series of commitments that a party will deliver if it's voted into power. But the reality is often quite different. Poorly thought out pledges turn out to be difficult to deliver in practice. Some pledges are never intended to be top government priorities. The crises and day-to-day challenges of government often mean commitments fall by the wayside. And in the case of no party winning a majority, a hung parliament means making compromises to ensure coalitions or partnerships. So on this episode, we'll be exploring how manifestos are made and costed, how the civil service use them, and ask what makes for a good or bad manifesto.
The manifesto itself is a selling document rather than a policy document as such, and it may describe in a sentence something that has underneath it a 30-page policy document.
Sir Oliver Letwin was at the centre of developing Conservative Party policy for more than a decade and was a cabinet minister under David Cameron.
For the manifesto, you need it to be drafted by people who understand how to sell policies rather than by people who are immersed in the detail of a specific policy area. But of course, the two have to match, because the manifesto, by being sold, to some extent at least, gives you permission then to introduce the policy to which the sentence or paragraph or page of the manifesto refers. And so that reference must be sufficiently accurate so that you can accurately say to Parliament after the election, we said this in our manifesto, here is the policy that represents that, we're now doing. And I think we did achieve that goal. And it would, of course, have formed the basis of the government in that sense. The manifesto and the policy papers around it and the business plans in which they were embodied would have been a coherent whole.
A manifesto can be both a political tool to win elections and contain the high-level policies a party aims to deliver if they win power. But how do parties go about writing a manifesto? Some political parties have much greater party involvement in the process of producing and signing off their manifesto. For Labour, the role of the wider membership is outlined in Clause 5 in the party's rulebook. In the past, many of Labour's manifesto commitments would first be agreed at their party conference, often leading to very public battles over policy. Sally Morgan, Tony Blair's former political secretary, told us how Labour set about trying to change the process in the 1990s.
I mean, there was a lot of process around getting ready for the manifesto for 97. So Tom Sawyer, who was then the General Secretary, I think had also learnt a lot and been burnt in the past. And therefore, we had this whole process called Road to the Manifesto, where in a sense, there was lots of work within the broader Labour Party about taking people through the arguments. And we developed this policy forum that was different than the annual conference and became the kind of policy body through which you could develop manifesto ideas. And in a sense, it became a more representative group, I suppose, within the Labour Party. Because, for example, it included councillors and council leaders who, in a way, were people who had direct experience of taking hard decisions and setting priorities.
The National Policy Forum is still part of Labour's policy process today. But putting together the final manifesto document is the responsibility of just a small group of advisers who are close to the party leader. The Liberal Democrats' manifesto process also involves consulting party committees, as Nick Clegg's former policy director, Polly McKenzie, explains.
There is a body of official policy documents, and those policy documents technically never expire unless they are superseded by a new policy document on the same topic. There's a federal policy committee, there's a federal conference committee, and between them they decide what it is that will be discussed and passed into policy. The federal policy committee is charged with authorising a manifesto. The party leader has traditionally appointed somebody as the chair of that process and chair of the federal policy committee to be their representative and to draw together out of that body of policy documents a sort of set of priorities for government.
The Conservatives' party manifesto process is very different, with little room for the wider party, and the final document normally drawn up by just a handful of people close to the leader, as Oliver Letwin told us.
In my experience of shadow cabinet membership in opposition between 2000 and 2010, every time we had a manifesto, and we had three of them in that time, the party leader arranged a shadow cabinet meeting, and there was about sort of 45 minutes to read it around the table. You couldn't take it away. And then there was a brief discussion at which it was agreed, because we were within minutes of issuing. Now, in that sense, shadow government was absolutely no input whatsoever into manifesto. That's misrepresenting the situation as a whole, however, because we had detailed discussions about what was in the section of the manifesto or sections of the manifesto that related to a specific shadow cabinet member with that shadow cabinet member. So when they came and saw the manifesto for the first time, they were seeing something which was new to them only in the sense that it was new in the areas that were not within their portfolio.
Ahead of the 2010 election, the Conservatives had experimented with a wider, more consultative process. Here's Kate Fall, David Cameron's former Deputy Chief of Staff.
In 2010, it was Oliver Letwin and Steve Hilton very much sort of held the pen on the manifesto. But there was also an attempt to bring ideas from outside, especially within the parliamentary party. Now, that was both a good thing and a tricky thing, because people have lots of ideas. We try to set up these committees and suggest ideas to the manifesto committee. The problem was some of them were either expensive or a bit outlandish, and they leaked into the press, and then that created political problems for us.
But whatever the agreed party process for manifesto writing, a snap election can see them thrown straight out of the window. In October 2007, Gordon Brown looked poised to call an election at any moment.
It was a terrible scramble. We did indeed think that he would call an election. I think everyone thought he'd call an election. I think some of the people closest to him thought he would call an election.
Here's Oliver Letwin.
And at the time when this was fever pitch, I was actually on holiday. What laughably passes for a holiday, because I really didn't see my family at all. I just buried myself in trying to produce something which was, with Steve Hilton and others, could do as a manifesto under the circumstances. We never really got to anything that was very satisfactory. And we then had the party conference, and the effects of the political mood and the two party conferences were sufficiently adverse to Brown's cause for him to retreat from having a general election. And so we never really completed the exercise.
Another factor that shapes how a manifesto is produced is whether a party's in government or in opposition. Oliver Letwin told us how writing the manifesto was much easier for the Conservatives in 2015, having already been in government for 5 years.
Devising policies for the manifesto was trivially easy because they were already there. There were some major strategic issues, but few, and not involving detailed policy work at all. And then there was simply the writing down of policies that were already framed, which was a mechanical exercise. And then there was the crafting of that into manifesto, which was never my domain, as I explained in the 2010 manifesto. It was Jacob Shaughnessy and Steve Hilton who read it, and likewise in the 2015 manifesto. I was not responsible for drafting. So, of course, I was responsible for checking that it cohered with our programme.
There was, of course, one significant Conservative pledge in 2015 which didn't quite work out as planned, the EU referendum.
There were a few issues to be resolved. One of them turned out to be a very major one, which was the question of what we said about a referendum on Brexit. But that's a huge strategic issue, but it's not a detailed policy issue. I mean, it's binary. You either say we're going to have a referendum, or you don't say we're going to have a referendum. You don't have to do the ideal of the policy work about how you would hold a referendum. That's a technical issue. Take care of itself.
Manifestos aren't just helpful to voters in making up their minds. In the run-up to an election, the civil service used them to see what a party might do if it were to win, as former Permanent Secretary Dame Sue Owen explains.
The main thing you've got to do in that period is to read the manifesto, think a bit about where there might be problems, particularly if there are delivery issues, thorough analysis like that, and then building that into the day one briefing that you prepare for each of the parties.
Moira Wallace, another former Permanent Secretary, told us how civil servants use manifestos to prepare for various election outcomes during the formal campaign period, previously known as PERDA.
Well, I think civil servants find them very useful and ideally read the whole thing, because it's quite important not just to read your own bit, but to think, well, actually, how does this fit in the wider context? Not just in terms of, you know, how many words on my department, but actually, oh, have you just said something about local government or public spending or the civil service or devolution is also going to matter? You know, during PERDA, it is your job to prepare for different governments, so you do, and you try and understand the context. Who thought these policies up? You know, often some of your external contacts can tell you quite a lot at that point, or may indeed have been telling you all along, because they're not bound by the same constraints. So you will find people in whatever sector or industry you work with have had quite a lot of contacts. But of course, their account of what these policies are and how they're going to be implemented may be refracted by their own position or what they'd like to be the case.
Before the formal campaign period begins and the parties release their manifestos, the governing party can ask the civil service to work out how much opposition policies would cost. Gemma Tetlow, chief economist here at the Institute for Government, explains how this works.
The government has the right to ask civil servants to cost opposition policies, and this is a pretty long-standing tradition in the UK that's been going on since at least the 1950s, and parties of both colour in power have used this privilege. And the idea is it's based on the grounds that the civil service provides advice to the government on its own costings and can provide some factual information to MPs and peers about government policies. Those assumptions going into the costings don't have to be and often aren't the most reasonable interpretation of the policy that the opposition have actually put forward. They can be chosen to make the policy look as unattractive as possible. And it's quite unfortunate that those opposition policy costings then get presented as official government numbers from the Treasury, when in fact they are really very much driven by those assumptions that are fed in by special advisers.
Once the formal campaign period begins, civil servants are no longer allowed to do opposition costings. But there is a fine line between the formal campaign period beginning and the days leading up to this.
In 2019, this did come to a head when the head of the civil service at the time, Mark Sedwill, refused to allow the Treasury to publish some opposition policy costings on the very last day before the election period started, arguing that that did inappropriately draw civil service into political discussions. So there is quite a fine line.
Once the manifestos are released, parties are under a lot of pressure to set out how much their commitments would cost and how they would pay for them. Here's former Permanent Secretary Sue Owen.
Obviously, the manifestos are usually more detailed than you have heard in the months and even years before the election, but they'll still be a bit cautious about how much things are going to cost, and particularly on the fiscal side, because all the parties will be very aware that the manifestos can be used in the campaign for a lot of scaremongering. I think it was back in 92, I think Labour put in quite a lot of detail and lived to regret it.
After their experience in 1992, Labour took steps to show how they could be trusted with the economy. Here's Gemma Tetlow.
There has been increasing focus in recent years, particularly since, I think, the advent of fiscal rules with Gordon Brown in 1997, for parties to want to be clear about how their numbers add up, as it were, that they're not making spending commitments they can't pay for with tax, or be clear how that's going to happen. And back in 1997, Gordon Brown and the Labour Party clearly felt under pressure to deflect the criticism that Labour would be irresponsible with the public finances, the sort of legacy of the 1970s. and therefore were clear that they had some fiscal rules and that their pledges were consistent with that and with consistent with keeping borrowing and debt down. That's continued to be a trend over the past couple of decades, with manifesto scrutiny focusing on do the numbers add up.
Political parties often produce their own costings document to show that their plans are fiscally credible. Since civil servants aren't allowed to publish official analysis of the manifestos during the campaign period, it falls to other independent organisations to check the manifestos really do add up.
What independent organisations like the Institute for Fiscal Studies and others try to do when they cost manifesto policies is, suppose a party has proposed raising taxes on a particular group of people. The first step of trying to cost that policy is to think, how many people are affected, how much of their income or spending or whatever the thing is that you're trying to tax, how big is that across the whole of the economy? So suppose a party has proposed increasing income tax. The first stage of trying to cost that policy would be to say, how many people are affected, how much income will be affected by this new tax, multiply those things together to come up with a first basic estimate of what the cost of that policy is, how much it's going to raise you. But usually that's not the end of the process, and actually it's a bit more complicated than that, because almost all taxes are going to affect how people behave. So if you were to introduce that tax, then actually people wouldn't behave how they're behaving at the moment. If you tax their income more, that means that they take home less money for every hour that they work. That could discourage them from working. Or conversely, if they need a certain level of income to survive, it may actually mean that they need to work a bit harder. So you need to think about all the ways in which people might respond to a tax change to come up with the final estimate of what that policy is going to cost. And some policies are very complicated, could have lots of different effects on people's behaviours. Some policies are relatively simple.
Working out how a change in behaviour might affect the cost of a policy can be quite complicated for costing those manifestos. But as Gemma Tetlow explains, there are a few different ways these calculations can be made.
The simplest way is to use some numbers that are put out every year by HM Revenue and Customs. HMRC publish a table of what they call tax-ready reckoners. These are basically numbers which say if you change any tax rate by a marginal 1% one way or the other, or you change a threshold by a little bit, how much is that going to cost or raise you? The second more complicated way of doing this, which you may need to use if you are considering a bigger tax change or perhaps a new tax or something that doesn't appear in those HMRC basic tables, is that organisations like the IFS and Resolution Foundation will have big tax and benefit simulation models. So they will run the tax changes through those simulation models, including estimates of how behaviours might change in future.
So a party has written its manifesto, the policies have been costed, and the media has scrutinised all the pledges. The electorate may or may not have paid attention. Then election day comes, and possibly overnight, a new government may be in power. What comes next?
I can remember in Downing Street having the 100 headlines of the manifesto or whatever. We all have them essentially on our walls and we tick them off. I mean, we were pretty focused on thinking we have got to deliver.
That was Tony Blair's former political secretary, Sally Morgan. She told us how manifestos aren't just important in the campaign, they continue to play a role once a party enters government. But whilst manifesto pledges aren't constitutionally binding, there are reasons why parties might want to stick to them once in power.
To what extent the public ever really heard us or noticed us that we were doing that, I don't know. But we felt it was very important, so you could always go back to say, well, we did do that. Of course, you go beyond that and you do extra things. But we felt that that was a core document that throughout our time, you could always refer back to. And I remember John Prescott in particular, who was, you know, a big campaigner. He liked to have that with him almost. So he could say, well, hang on a second, stop, you know, look. All you naysayers, look, actually, we have done 60 of these so far or whatever.
But some people we spoke to had a slightly different perspective on how manifestos should be used in government. Here's Jonathan Powell, Tony Blair's former chief of staff.
The manifesto, as all manifestos, is largely designed for politics, for winning elections. We'd actually been quite careful not to make too many bold promises, hence our pledge cards were just the very small minimalist pledges on it. But what was striking was, because the civil servants, of course, were keen to demonstrate that they were not Conservative Party card-carrying members. And so what they had to go on was manifesto and then conversations with to the cabinet members. And some of them rather overdid it. They felt they had to demonstrate left-wing credentials by overinterpreting the manifesto. And Tony often talked about how he had to sort of rein in the civil servants' wilder left-wing tendencies. And I don't think that was because they were naturally left-wing. It was just they felt they had to compensate on the other side. So the trouble with manifestos, and actually I've seen this in many elections, they're not meant to be taken entirely literally by civil servants, or indeed by, and aren't taken literally by the public. The number of people who actually read a manifesto is not that great. And they're often pandering to, or a more polite way would be put it, tailored for individual lobbies on particular subjects who care about particular things.
In 1997, Labour were careful not to overpromise for the obvious reason that parties don't want to feel constrained by commitments that might be popular with voters, but aren't actually deliverable in government, or wouldn't stand the test of time if circumstances changed. Gus O'Donnell was Cabinet Secretary for the 2010 election. He told us what the civil service find most helpful from a manifesto once a party comes into government.
What is it that you really, really care about? What outcomes? You know, imagine 5 years' time. What would you like us, what would you like the country to look like? And if they can specify that, then you start to go back and say, okay, so we're here. How do we get there? What are the best policies to do that? Let's look at the evidence. And then as civil servants, we can come back to them and say, look, here are five different ways you might do this. One of them might be the way you've got in your manifesto, if you've been explicit about the how. Here are four others. You've got the choice. You could stick with the one in your manifesto, or you could look at these others and say, well, actually, you know, option three looks a lot better. Better value for money, seems to deliver what I want. Could we go with option three, please?
In 2010, the Conservatives wanted to reduce the deficit through spending cuts. Kate Fall told us how setting this out in the Conservative manifesto helped them to press ahead with these cuts early on.
Well, obviously, the thing about manifestos is if you win off the back of them, you have a mandate. And the economic plan was set out in that document. And that was quite a high risk strategy, actually, in 2010. And in some ways, you could argue that we got quite near to that becoming a big problem coming up to the 2010 election. Labour were making real headway with cuts. But it was in the manifesto that the cuts programme, and that was basically others before, like Geoffrey Howard said, you know, you've got to have a mandate to do those difficult things.
Having major and potentially controversial policies in a manifesto can help a party create political space for these ideas and gain the voters' consent to take bold decisions if they enter power. There are also constitutional reasons why manifesto pledges become important once a party enters power, as Gus O'Donnell explains.
They may be particularly important this year because if Labour were to win, they'd be in a situation where there'll be quite a big majority against them in the House of Lords. The convention is that if something's in the manifesto, the Lords won't vote against it. So that will mean that Labour will need to be more careful about what they put in their manifesto this time.
Manifestos can play a different role for smaller parties, as Polly McKenzie explained.
We'd taken four priority goals and we had put them on the front page of the manifesto on the cover. And we said that whatever power we got, whatever votes we got, we would use that to try and secure progress towards those four goals. And that the rest of the manifesto was a bit more of a theoretical construct. That was at the core of our preparation for what we imagined might turn into either coalition negotiations or some other sort of negotiation with other political parties in the event of a hung parliament. But at the core of our preparation was really, it was preparing for negotiation. We weren't, if I'm honest, preparing for government.
But this can go wrong. The Liberal Democrats' 2010 commitment to scrap tuition fees has become notorious as a pledge they U-turned on after entering into coalition, though the party leadership had previously explored how to leave this pledge out from the manifesto.
Tuition fees is the obvious one, where the party's processes had commissioned a policy paper on tuition fees, which Stephen Williams, MP for Bristol West, I think, had chaired, and they brought forward a set of proposals to basically broadly accept the direction of travel of the idea of tuition fees, but propose a range of relatively progressive reforms to that. And that was basically that failed because we knew that the party wouldn't support it. And instead, we decided to just deprioritise the tuition fees pledge within the manifesto rather than take the fight to the party. It didn't feel worth the kind of the political cost of doing that, though turns out the political cost was a bit greater later on.
For the Conservatives, being upfront about austerity in their manifesto before the election became important in coalition negotiations and into government, as Kate Fall explains.
others before, like Geoffrey Howard, said, you know, you've got to have a mandate to do those difficult things. And then in the coalition document, and that really was, in a way, the cement that bound that the whole way through. An example of where we didn't do that well was the health reforms, where there wasn't really very much in the manifesto at all about it, just a bit of ambiguous wording. And then when they suddenly bounced onto the statute book, it didn't go so well.
As the election approaches, all parties will be deciding which pledges they want to put to the country in the campaign. The final word in this episode goes to Tony Blair's former advisor, Sally Morgan, with her advice for those writing the party manifestos this time round.
I think more than ever, actually, when trust is such a significant issue, the more that you can be straight and transparent and also say that you do have to have priorities and you can't promise everything. And therefore, let's be really straightforward about what we are saying we will do and when we will do them, whether it's a first term or increasingly, I've noticed our current front bench talking about 10 years, i.e. two terms. It's going to take two terms to do X, Y, and Z. I think that's the right thing to do personally, because I think the more that you can have that conversation with the public in a sort of unmediated way, the better, really.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Preparing for Power from the Institute for Government. In our next episode, we'll be taking you inside the first days, weeks and months of a new government.
You end up with an exhausted Prime Minister and staff who've been on an election campaign for at least 3 weeks, usually much longer. No sleep, that particular night, then forcing them to take decisions about nuclear weapons, who's in the government and how the country's going to be run. It's not ideal.
He said, Tony's not your friend. He's the Prime Minister. And he was trying to tell me something very profound, which is when you get into government, all your relationships change.
We'll be speaking to former ministers, their advisers and senior civil servants about how it feels entering Downing Street on the day after the election and what actually happens on a minister or Prime Minister's first day in office. We'll be looking at how a new government can get those first weeks and months right, and all the things that can and sometimes do go wrong. See you next time.